Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Other Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Stacy McCain.
And I'm the other guy on the Other Podcast. Hi, folks. I'm John Hogue. By the way, I don't know that I've mentioned this before, but I think maybe I have with previous podcasts. Stacy blogs at a blog called theothermccain.com, and you can also find his excellent scribbling at other fine websites about the internet, like the spectator.org. That's a good place to look.
Yes, and you may find my good friend John Hogue's work at hoguewash.com. It's 7 o'clock on a Saturday night, and being that this is October and happy Halloween to everyone, that means that we have college football scores to report. Number one, Clemson came back in the second half to defeat Boston College 34-28. They were trailing 28-13 at the half, but then scored 21 points in the second half to win. Notre Dame, meanwhile, defeats Georgia Tech in Atlanta. Other scores, let's see. Oh, yes. Number 13, Michigan, lost at home to Michigan State. That score was 27-24, and I'm told that the first-year coach at Michigan State is the first Michigan State coach to defeat Michigan in his first year as coach, head coach, since Nick Saban did it many years ago. So,
well, my father-in-law went to Michigan, so I suppose I'm supposed to care, but I also have a lot of friends who went to engineering school at Michigan State, so I guess I'll just be neutral on that one.
Number 17, Indiana is leading Rutgers 37-21 with about 3 minutes left in the fourth quarter. Number 25, Boise State trails Air Force 17-14, still in the first half there. Georgia, number 5 ranked Georgia, looked kind of weak, squeaking out a 14-3 victory over Kentucky at Kentucky.
Well, they didn't have to work that hard for that one, so why bother?
Yeah. Cincinnati, ranked number 7th, defeats Memphis 49-10. Kansas State, ranked number 16th, lost at West Virginia 37-10. Coastal Carolina, ranked number 20th. Coastal Carolina, 51, Georgia State, 0. And number 23 ranked, Iowa State, 52, Kansas, 22. In late games tonight, just in a few minutes, Mississippi State will be kicking off in Tuscaloosa against the number 2 ranked Alabama Crimson Tide, Roll Tide. And the Ohio State Buckeyes, ranked number 3 and undefeated. Well, they've only played one game. Anyways, Ohio State will be at number 14. And no, I'm sorry, number 18, Penn State.
So yes, it's going to be the borderline state bowl there.
Yeah. Yeah, the battleground states. Yeah, yeah, the swing state bowl there in the Nittany Valley. Penn State at home. And so that now you have got all your scores, and now we can talk about other stuff.
Well, there's good news, at least this week.
Yeah. By the way, where's Diana?
She's in the background waiting to say something. Hello, Diana.
Hey there. Did you know that aside from being Halloween and 2020?
Mm-hmm. Say again.
But it's it's Halloween. Yeah. It's a full moon. It's it's a fallback day.
Yes.
And last but certainly not least, it's a blue moon.
Yes.
It's 2020.
And it's 2020.
Yeah. The craziest year in history.
And a full moon, a full moon, blue moon on Halloween. And I don't know if you saw the Are You Pondering What I'm Pondering thing at noon today at Hogwash, but basically Pinky was saying, instead of setting the clock back an hour, why don't we just set it ahead 2 months?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Diana did something really brilliant this year. Last year, she abandoned San Francisco, which is circling the toilet bowl, and moved to Valdosta, Georgia, which is one of the saner places on the planet.
Yes,
that
she did.
Is.
And but there is, as I was saying, good news this week. There was a swearing-in ceremony in the first part of the week.
Yes, the Senate voted 52-48 to confirm Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. And the rhetoric from Democrats was so over the top that viewers of CNN or MSNBC might be forgiven if they believe that upon her confirmation, Justice Barrett immediately obtained the power to cancel everybody's health insurance and much else besides. But the Democrats were completely over the top about this. And I, on my blog, I reminded everyone of the history of Borking, which goes back to 1987 when Ted Kennedy just slandered Robert Bork, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan to the court. But then that was just a warm up for the 1990 Clarence Thomas confirmation
and
hearings.
I thought it was a wonderful gesture toward the former vice president for Justice Thomas to swear in Justice Barrett.
Yeah, a dish best served cold. And so so the stakes couldn't be higher. This was an in your face move by Cocaine Mitch, as we call him.
The murderer.
It was a wonderful there was a wonderful meme of him early in the week saying, "I'm here to deal cocaine and
confirm
justices, and I'm all out of cocaine."
All out of cocaine.
Yeah, but yes, the murder turtle, as Diana recalls, was really up there. And but anyways, this is a really strong move by McConnell on the eve of the election. You know, it's like here you go. What do you voted for?
Well, so, not only that, but the very next day he moved for cloture on some more district judges.
Yes. So, but yes, it has been quite the week.
Yeah, but you know what the most disgusting thing about the over-the-top reactions to Barrett's confirmation was? The Girl Scouts of America put up a tweet congratulating her on being the fifth woman to become an Associate Justice of the Court, and they were ratioed so heavily they pulled the tweet down and apologized.
Yeah. The cancel culture, you cannot appease those people. I mean, you just
no,
have to.
That's why you shouldn't try.
Exactly.
Well, this reminds me of, and this is a way to segue to the next topic. That whole thing, that whole response reminds me of the title of one of my blog posts this week, which was Turning It Up to 11. except I spelled 11 in Roman numerals. And it was actually a very short blog post, and I'll just read it. There's a joke about Hunter's laptop and Chinese bribery that includes a pun dealing with Roman numerals and the Chinese leader's name, but I'm too busy working for a living to figure out the details.
Right. Yeah. They didn't want to, what happened is that, of course, on October 14th, the New York Post, which is one of the oldest papers in America,
It's the oldest one that's still in operation.
Yeah, originally published by Alexander Hamilton, no less.
Mm.
But the New York Post published on an expose based on emails obtained from Hunter Biden's laptop. Well, Twitter bought into a Democrat narrative, claiming that somehow this was fake news, that this was that.
Actually, they were probably, along with Facebook, the origin of the narrative.
Right. The claim that the
hacked information.
Yeah, this was hacked, that the Russian disinformation, whatever. Anyways, and so they took the extraordinary step of locking down the Twitter account of the New York Post. But then on Friday, Twitter backed down, and I'm reading from the New York Post now. Twitter backed down Friday in its battle with the Post and unlocked its main account after a two-week stalemate over the Hunter Biden expose. The move came after the Post refused Twitter's demand that it delete six tweets that linked to stories that the company, that is Twitter, claimed without any evidence were based on hacked information.
Actually, it's even worse. It's not that they were making the claim without evidence. They were making the claim that, and they knew it was contrary to the evidence.
Right. The Post never budged and kept the tweets on the account during the standoff. In a series of tweets, the social media giant said it was revising its hacked policy material and updating our practice of, quote, not retroactively overturning prior enforcement. Look, they did this to me, is that they create some kind of standard and then they won't tell you how you have violated it.
That's so, because they got you after they got me. I was one of the first people they got. But go ahead and talk about the Post for a while, and then we're going to talk about what happened to me.
So they were trying to suppress a story simply because it reflected badly on the Biden campaign. And I am sure that after the election, we will learn that the Biden campaign basically issued orders through the executives at Twitter to do this.
Well, actually, there's information that has come out that basically says that federal law enforcement had warned Twitter and Facebook that it was coming. So that's kind of scary if it's true. When I first started using Twitter about 8 years ago, it was still more or less an open platform where I was able to interact with folks on both sides of the political aisle. But by 2015, it had evolved into a space that was much less friendly for conservatives. I was one of the first conservatives permanently banned, allegedly because I was engaged in, and this is a quote, targeted abuse. And they told not only me that that was the reason, they told other people that that was the reason. Targeted abuse of a left-wing political operative. I'm also one of the very few people who's been permanently banned to have at least one of my accounts restored. When it turned out the allegations against me were false, Twitter appeared to learn from the episode, and they've been more careful in the way they describe the reasons for lockouts and bans. That's the reason why they were nebulous with you, because they opened themselves up to a defamation suit in the way they handled me. So by being nebulous about their, and I'll use scare quotes here, rules, they managed to avoid making provably false statements when they punish users. And that has protected them from defamation claims. Now that has changed this year. Twitter is now willing to punish users who publish truthful material. At least they were until Friday, apparently. Twitter has now admitted that the Post story was true, but they were still until Friday punishing the Post for truthfulness. Now, based on what I can see, Twitter is afraid of the changes that might come about in the regulatory and the economic environment in a second Trump administration. And they basically have reached the point where they're all in. They don't care about how things look, or at least they didn't until Friday. Things may be a little bit different. And I think one of the things that happened was the Senate's hearing. Because after the Senate hearing, Twitter's stock price drops enough that the institutional investors in the company took a haircut of over $2 billion in one day.
Yeah.
And then they unlocked the Post. So it may be, you know, I've written before that we maybe need to tweak Section 230, which has to do with the kind of shielding that outfits like Twitter and our blogs get because of third, you know, we're protected from what third parties say, but we're not protected from what we say. And that may need some tweaking, but I really think that the market is going to hurt Twitter and Facebook and Google harder than the government can, sooner than the government can. And that's going to provide a more beneficial response. Meanwhile, I've invested in Gab. So I got involved in Gab when they did their first offering. So
I
mentioned that basically because since I am a shareholder in one of Twitter's competitors, I should be open about that.
Yeah.
But this whole thing has to do with the way that part of media and social media are tied in with the deep state and with the politicians who are part of that alliance. J.E. Dyer has a post up over at Liberty Unyielding, and I've got a link to it at Hogwash. She goes through the timeline of the FBI investigation of Hunter Biden's laptop and parallels it with other stuff that was going on. And she points out that the deep state and its allies have known about what Biden was doing all along, because mm-hmm. they're part of it, whereas Trump and his supporters have been learning about Biden and the Ukraine and all the other hidden stories as they've turned over various rocks and have seen what wriggled out from underneath them. And she points out that there's some patience needed in this. We don't need to have somebody get indicted and then get off. Right. We need to nail them. So, you know, I've been disappointed that so far only one Department of Justice lawyer has, and who was involved in the fraud against the court on the warrant applications for the FISA court, has been taken down before the election. But you know what? I'd rather see people nailed than people get off after they've been accused. So patience, everybody, and vote early.
Or
if you can't get there on election day. I still want folks to vote on election day because we'll get into the margin of theft later.
Yeah.
Well, let me give you an update, by the way. Alabama scored on its first possession thanks in large measure to two pass interference calls against Mississippi State. They got down there and kicked a field goal, so it's now Alabama 3, Mississippi State 0. And I know that our podcast listeners are just hanging, you know, like all of us, the entire country cares about Alabama football. Right? Come on. What is this?
Friend. Okay, what, roll
what
tide.
What kind of world is this? Thank you.
Roll tide.
Thank you. Roll tide. Roll. Anyways, meanwhile, this week we learned that Anonymous, the supposedly senior administration official.
Now, we're talking about Anonymous of the byline for somebody who's been writing op-eds and stuff.
Right,
like that,
right.
As opposed to the alleged
two
hacking
years ago. 2 years ago, the New York Times published an op-ed column by someone who described himself as part of the anti-Trump resistance inside the administration. And
in other words, a member of the deep state.
He was called the New York Times called him a senior administration official. It turns out that he was a low level staffer, the deputy chief of staff to Kirsten. What was her name? The secretary Nielsen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kirsten Nielsen, when she was Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Well, anyways, Miles Taylor is his name, and he is he's from Indiana, and not, so far as I know, a homosexual. By the way, I know because of Mayor Pete. As soon as you hear that someone's from Indiana, now you would assume that they're homosexual, but it turns out that Miles Taylor is so far as we know, heterosexual. But anyways, but that's not the point. The point is that he's a selfish creep.
With delusions of grandeur.
I think it's more like delusions of adequacy.
Well, I saw this interview that he gave to someone in which he described John McCain, the late unlamented senator from Arizona, John McCain as a lifelong personal hero of mine, close quote. That tells you everything you need to know. By the way, did you know that in 2008, 2008, John McCain got only 173 Electoral College votes.
Oh, yeah.
He got less than 46% of the vote. And I don't know if anyone believes that Donald Trump will do worse than that. But we'll get to that later. But John McCain lost the entire Midwest, not to mention Florida, North Carolina, Virginia, Nevada, and Colorado. He was, and so if you're in favor of losing elections, you see, John McCain is your lifelong personal hero. And so goodbye, Miles Taylor.
Well, you know, he lied to CNN when he was asked point blank on their air.
And they hired him, by the way. No, he's been hired as a contributor to CNN, even though he lied to Anderson Cooper. See, because CNN does not hire honest people. Go ahead.
Well, they make mistakes. But they usually don't fit in.
I can't think of an honest person who's been on CNN.
Tucker Carlson.
Once upon a time. Yes. Yeah, they got rid of
Robert Novak.
This is now.
Yes, but 30 years ago or more, CNN was actually a real journalistic organization, you know. So, you know, but that isn't what we have now.
No.
Yes.
I mean, it was a CNN personality who asked the question that ended the Dukakis candidacy. If you remember, so you know it was they used to do real journalism, but now they have basically become part of the alliance that includes in the bureaucracy the deep state and certain politicians and a big chunk of news or what passes for news organizations in the country. You know, and that makes it hard for some of us who live in what I call red enclaves that are surrounded by blue. I live in one of the counties in Maryland where Republicans outnumber Democrats. Carroll County's registration is roughly 2-1 Republican, a ratio that is only exceeded out in Garrett County, which is the far western county in the state out in the panhandle, which is about 3-1, which means there's probably 4,000 Republicans out there. It's a very sparsely populated area. Anyway, Maryland is majority Democrat as a whole. Baltimore and some and the counties that are the suburban counties around D.C., the registration is like 10-1 Democrat.
Wow.
And the state's 2-1 as a whole, roughly the mirror image of where I live. But I feel perfectly safe having a Trump-Pence sign in my front yard. But it would be an act of bravery in most of the heavily populated areas in the state. And there was an anonymous writer, one of my neighbors someplace in Maryland, in the Spectator of Stacy, titled Confessions of a Secret Suburban Trump Mom. And she writes, I grew up all over the place, but consider Maryland my home.
Well, by the way, that's not the American Spectator.
Right.
That is U.S. edition of the British Spectator. And that's completely confusing. That's spectator.us.
Yes.
Anyway,
while I live in a more rural small town, I'm acutely aware that I live in a blue state as soon as I make my way outside our area. It's hard staying under the radar in general, but even more so in a variety of settings, including my workplace. It's especially hard to bite my tongue when people openly share liberal views, assuming everyone feels the same way. I find it hard to swallow that people are either blindly following or just not paying attention at all. I want to scream at them and say, wake up, you're being played. It seems the tone and tenor of our state changed once Obama vowed to fundamentally transform America. I know I can't be the only one who thinks this. And, you know, she's not the only one who thinks that way. I'm beginning to see evidence of cracks in the monolithic support for Democrats, even in the suburban areas around D.C. There are Trump-Pence signs showing up in places like Laurel, Maryland, which is like suburban D.C., full of federal workers. Now, I don't think Maryland's going to flip red on the 3rd, but I'm reasonably certain that Trump's going to do better here than he did in 2016.
We will see. I keep saying that. I'm later in the program. Well, we will get to all this predictive business, which offends me deeply, by the way. But that's
well,
okay.
Basically, if the vote is depressed, and you have essentially the same Republican or slightly better Republican turnout because of enthusiasm, and the Democrats get 300,000 fewer votes, Trump still can't carry the state. So, but the enthusiasm is interesting. If you go in areas that are roughly 2-1 Democrat, you don't see 2-1 Biden signs.
Yeah.
And on the way here this evening, I drove past 90 houses that had some sort of political display. 68 of them were for Trump. 20 of them were for Biden. And two of them were for any responsible adult.
Okay. Anyways, one of my blog posts this week, and I'll read the whole thing because
before
it's short.
We do that, we should tell people the sort of thing they see when they look at your blog post, particularly that right at the center top.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, if you will go to my blog, theothermccain.com, you will notice near the top of the page in the center column, a yellow button with the word donate. If you will click on the yellow button, it will take you to my PayPal account where you can contribute to the support of the blog and also to the podcast. Meanwhile, at my good friend John Hogue's site, hoguewash.com.
There is over in the sidebar over on the right a tip jar icon. You click on that and you're taken off through the magic of the internet and electronical stuff to my PayPal account where you can make a donation to help support Hogue Wash, or you can scroll down in the sidebar and you can click on the icon of the hat and it'll take you off to the Hogue Wash store where you can buy all sorts of interesting goodies, trinkets, and junk branded in various ways associated with the blog. And there's shopping links at Hogue Wash for Amazon and at the other McCain and lots of other blogs, actually, because there's this thing called the Amazon Affiliates Program that allows those of us who participate to receive a small commission when people make qualified purchases through those links. So whichever way you choose, we appreciate your support, but principally we're looking for you to remember the five most important words in the English language. Take it away, Diana.
The five most important words in the English language are hit the freaking tip jar.
Amen.
Thank you. Well, let's see. Where were we before that interruption from capitalism? Oh, yes.
We were dealing with a state of calm despair. And yes. And non-capitalist non-solutions.
Okay. This week I had a post called Whatever Your Problem Is, Electing Democrats Will Never Be the Solution.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only political principle you need to guide your election choices. Never vote for a Democrat nor support any policy endorsed by Democrats. Insofar as it is possible, avoid residing in any community where Democrats are a majority. But if it happens that you find yourself living in a blue state, e.g. California, try to find a place to live in that state that is red. For instance, Kern County.
Or when I was in California, Ventura County or Orange County, alas, no longer.
Yes. Anyways, apply the same principle to your choices in terms of education and employment. Where should you go to college? Some place where students care more about football than social justice. Where should you work? A private sector company that actually produces goods and services for profit, and not one of these gigantic woke conglomerates that embraces progressive values. Democrats always ruin everything. Communities that were once peaceful and prosperous can rapidly be converted into dangerous hellholes if the people start electing Democrats. Once upon a time, up until the 1960s, Detroit was one of America's great cities. Then Democrats got in charge of the place and turned it into a desolation where many acres of residential property were bulldozed into vacant lot. Every law-abiding resident who could afford to get out of Detroit fled the Democrat-controlled city. And a similar process can now be observed in many other places that Democrats have turned into hell holes. The Joe Biden campaign is about doing to America what Democrats have done to Detroit and Baltimore and Chicago and every other crime-plagued hellhole city in America. If you want the entire country to become violent and dangerous, populated by criminals, drug addicts, and sex offenders, then by all means, you should elect Joe Biden president.
Yeah. But Stacey, how do you really feel about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, see, here's the thing. I was born and raised a Democrat, and I'm got over it.
I am a recovering Democrat myself.
I'm not.
I grew up in Nashville, and Stacey, I'm going to flop the next two stories because I'm just going to go ahead and talk about growing up in Nashville. Nashville is a really kind of interesting place. It was where like a bunch of railroads intersected with until they had built a bunch of dams on the Cumberland River, the last place you could get the barges upstream.
The headwaters of navigation. Yes.
On one of the major river systems of the country, because you go down the Cumberland and just upstream of Paducah, you're in the Ohio River, and then it's not far to the Mississippi. So Nashville was this wonderful center of trade and of education and of the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. And then because of its connections to publishing, various religious organizations, I mean, the Methodist Sunday School Board, the Baptist Sunday School Board, it was the intersection of like three interstate highways. It's been a wonderful center of trade, but it's been over 100 years since it had a Republican mayor. Mm. And over basically those Democrats, though, had come out of the business community for a great deal. And the city was at least well managed, even if it had some silly policies. My generation blew it. The boomers who got their hands on Nashville destroyed the city economically. And it's been particularly acute over the last 10 or 15 years. There's been just all sorts of wasteful public spending that has driven the city into the ground. You know, it still has its wonderful culture. It still has great companies headquartered there. It's still got wonderful educational, particularly higher education. But it has just been, it is teetering on bankruptcy almost like a blue state. Even though it's completely surrounded by red, the only other place that you see that kind of blueness in Tennessee is Memphis. And so it's just, you know, as much as I would like to go home to Nashville, maybe in my retirement, I don't think I can afford it anymore. Because what's going to have to happen in terms of taxation in order to bail the city out is just going to be ugly. But yeah, we're
there
better.
Was a great piece that you had there.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a, there's a, but you know.
Wait, you're starting to sound like Joe Biden over there. Get it together, John.
Well, I'm almost as old as Joe Biden, but at least I can still pronounce most of the words.
What was that?
Oh my God. If you didn't see the videos this week, Joe Biden gave a couple of speeches in which he got gibberish up there. He can't even pronounce the words anymore, but he shouts them very loudly.
Well, I've seen a couple of things. He came up with enough syllables when he said that somebody has done they've taken his face and put it on Dick Van Dyke's in the video, they have him sing. It's a
super califragilistic expialidocious.
Actually, I'll just go ahead and talk about tomorrow's. Are you pondering why I'm pondering? I can't come up with the pronunciation of what he said, but apparently it's over the counter in China.
I finally found a longer clip, and I think what he meant was he meant true international pressure. I think that may have been what he meant to say, but...
Yes, that he has a strategy to mobilize true international pressure. I think that's what he was talking... I have no idea, by the way, what that was in reference to at the time.
Neither do I.
But he was trying to say this, but it just didn't come out right. And later he was saying something about healthcare, and that also didn't come out correctly.
Yeah, well, on the other hand, he's a Democrat, and we've been talking about how well Democrats manage. Look at what they've done with Philadelphia.
Yeah, Philadelphia. Anyways, yes, we had two or three nights of riots this week in Philadelphia, and we're told that this is about systemic racism and social justice and everything else. And boy, if you saw the video of this thing, the guy charged at it, he had an 8-inch knife in his hand, a guy named Walter Wallace Jr., charged at two police officers while brandishing an 8-inch knife. This touched off riots, mostly peaceful protests, I meant to say. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. 76 people were arrested. About 90 people were arrested in the first two nights. Dozens of policemen were injured, including one who was run over by a truck. And it was just chaos and pandemonium. They were looting and everything else. And but the fact is that the guy at the center of all this uproar, Walter Wallace Jr., 27 years old, was a menace. He was a public menace. Police had been called dozens of times in recent months about the problems that Walter Wallace Jr. was causing. And they had, by the time they went there, the third time they went there, they had already been out there twice on Monday to deal with disturbances. And this was the third time they went there. And he charged at them with a knife. And the news coverage wants to talk about Walter Wallace Jr. having mental health problems. Well, he was a career criminal. Okay. He had convictions for a series of crimes, including resisting arrest and robbery. Court records show that city judges routinely sought to get him mental health treatment. I linked on my blog, I linked to a site called Information Liberation with Chris Minahan. As he said, Walter Wallace has so many mugshots, I couldn't fit them all into one properly sized header image. He had a criminal record going back so far, I can't even find the whole thing. Among his arrests, okay, were... When he, just this March, he was arrested for threatening the mother of his child over the phone saying, quote, I'll shoot you and that house up, close quote. oh, man. In 2013, okay, this takes the cake. In 2013, Wallace's mother, his own mother, had a protective order against him, which he allegedly violated when he, quote, threw water in her face and punched her in the face, and threatened to return and shoot her, according to court records. He punched his own mother in the face, and we're supposed to be sad that the cops shot him. It's civil rights. He's got a civil right to punch his mother in the face. I mean, this guy was, like I said, he's a criminal menace, and yet they're burning down and looting Philadelphia because his life mattered, I suppose.
Wow.
You know, yeah, and you're a racist if you think, well, hey, this guy wasn't exactly a model citizen.
Well, yes and no. Actually, I think he's the very model of a modern, he's the very model of a modern,
inner city,
new age,
Democrat?
Inner city citizen. Yes, that's the way to do it. But I mean, you know, I'll have to spend some time trying to figure out how to,
well, anyways, make there a Gilbert is and one Sullivan less live Trump, one less live Biden voter in Philadelphia. Unfortunately, you don't have to be alive to vote Democrat in Philadelphia.
I'm sure he
voted early before he charged the cops with a knife.
No. My father-in-law in Chicago never voted for a Democrat while he was alive.
Right. You know, it's like Baltimore, man. I think Edgar Allan Poe still votes in Baltimore.
There was one election sometime after
he voted fraudulently on the day of his death, what, three times at least?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Meanwhile,
there was one precinct that, and it was these votes were found, and they wound up being the margin of victory in a gubernatorial election after we got here. There was one precinct in Baltimore that actually had more votes than population.
Right.
Not registration, population.
Yeah, it's crazy. But the good news, I've been trying to do everything possible to avoid the good news.
Well, there's good news this week.
But the good news is Democrats are worried. Mm-hmm. People keep telling me their predictions about the election, and I don't want to hear them.
I'm going to give you mine anyway later.
I have done the Electoral College arithmetic and know that it is easily possible for President Trump to win, even if it's going to be close and we might have to wait for late returns. More than that, however, I've reached my zen of pessimistic calm. As I said in a blog on Wednesday, bleak hopelessness is true objectivity. Being convinced we are utterly doomed is a source of tranquility. Okay? See, that's the thing. Once you realize it doesn't matter, you're going to lose, nothing matters, you're going to vote, but you're going to lose, then you don't care.
Stacy, I went to Vanderbilt.
Oh my God! Yeah, yeah, you're good at losing. Okay, Democrats are now suffering an agony of fear. Four more years of Trump? No, they can't handle that. It's driving them to sheer panic. Okay, I'm now quoting from Politico. Okay, not a right-wing website, by the way, Politico. Democrats are sounding the alarm about weak voter turnout rates in Florida's biggest county, Miami-Dade, where a strong Republican showing is endangering Joe Biden's chances in the nation's biggest swing state. No Democrat can win Florida without a huge turnout and big winning margins in Miami to offset losses elsewhere in the states. But Democrats are turning out at lower rates than Republicans and at lower rates than at this point in 2016 when Hillary Clinton won Miami-Dade by 29 percentage points, but still lost the state to Donald Trump. So
the same thing's happening in the Tampa Bay area as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. There are other omens of a possible miracle victory for Trump, including a Rasmussen poll that indicates Trump may get 31%. I repeat, 31% of the black vote. But don't give me hope.
The last Republican who got that a percentage like that of the black vote was Hoover.
Yep.
But don't give me hope. I'm more comfortable with despair, especially as I watch Democrats writhe in agony during these final days before the election. And then I linked to one of my American Spectator columns from this week. I had two of them this week over at spectator.org, which I point out 12 years ago, when the Republican Party nominated John McCain as its presidential candidate, he got less than 46% of the popular vote and only 173 electoral college votes. Mm-hmm. Whatever happens on Election Day this year, almost no one expects President Trump to do that, do worse than that. Mm-hmm. And
but you know what? Let's pretend for a second that Trump wins. Do you know how difficult that can be for me personally? Remember, well, we should point out that we're Tuesday night, we're going to be doing a special election edition.
Oh, yes, right, folks. Join us Tuesday. We're going to have a special election watch.
If Trump is reelected, the closer I get back into the Baltimore, D.C. area when I start going home, I'm going to have to be very careful with the route I take because of the possibility of flash flooding from liberal tears.
Yeah. you know, that's the thing is that, I mean, I was watching Fox News, as a matter of fact, and everything I was seeing was just like an omen of doom. Okay. It's just like that. It was very depressing. And, everything I saw pointed toward a Biden win. And I pointed out, I am a professional journalist and I'm not supposed to care who wins election. So I am trying very hard to obtain the kind of zen of hopeless despair that I had in 2016 when my wife and I went to vote 4 years ago. And we were convinced that Hillary was going to win, but we voted for Trump anyway. And then we came back home and then we sat down on the sofa in the den down there in front of the TV, you know, with it on the election returns. And I was reclined on the sofa with a book. I was reading a history book and trying to block it out because I really had no hope at all. And then, you know, they're going, well, this is too close to call. And this is too close to call. And I began looking at the numbers, you know, that were coming in, you know, from Georgia and North Carolina, Florida, too close to call. Pennsylvania, too close to call. What the? Pennsylvania, too close to call. I could have expected Iowa. I mean, I'm sorry. I would have expected Ohio to be too close to call, but Pennsylvania, too close to call. And then, I kept watching and then suddenly, well, North Carolina for Trump. Now, that was the first state he flipped, by the way. It was North Carolina was the first state that he flipped back from what Obama had won twice. And then next thing you know, it looks like Florida, you know, and then about 11 o'clock, the avalanche started, you know, the people on MSNBC and CNN and all the other networks.
I so much enjoyed watching MSNBC that night.
That was the best night of MSNBC programming ever.
Yes. Meanwhile, we don't know that we're going to have a rerun of it, but you've got the best advice that I know that we can give folks, and that's keep calm and vote Trump.
Keep calm and vote Trump. That's what I said.
And that's different from the advice I gave in 2016. In 2016, if you were in a state like Maryland or Tennessee, where it didn't matter how you voted, the state was going to go one way or the other, I was recommending people vote for actually Gary Johnson, because he was the third party candidate most likely to get 5% of the vote, possibly. And if he gets if a minor party gets 5% of the vote, they get federal matching funds in the next election. And boy, imagine what this election would have been like if the libertarians had had matching money.
Yeah. Well, not
I mean, in terms of the entertainment value, to say nothing of, you know, what might be going on with other stuff. Well, this year, you need to vote. There's too much closeness. Mm-hmm. Vote.
Yeah.
And vote for, and my advice is vote for Trump.
The point is that everyone is, and I have been trying to tamp down all this talk about civil war. I was working, I've got a piece due Monday for the American Spectator print edition. By the way, if you go to spectator.org, you can find over there, if you subscribe to the Spectator, we do still put out a print magazine. We're going to have one right after the election. It's going to have a long piece about me, from me, talking about the prospects of a civil war, and I just tell people to shut up. But one of my favorite YouTubers, Tim Pool, I don't know if you know who Tim Pool is. He does
recommend that folks follow him.
Yeah, YouTube.com Timcast. That's TimCast.
And if you don't do YouTube, at least follow him on Twitter.
Yeah. And Tim Pool is a mixed race guy, by the way. I think most people don't realize this, but I believe it was his grandparents who would have been illegal for them to marry prior to loving the Virginia. So anyways, Tim, back during the unrest in 2011, he was an international correspondent. He live streamed from Kiev during the turmoil in Ukraine, and he has been on the scene. He is a shoe leather guy, but he keeps telling people, said, man, you better think about, you know, what's going to happen. Because, you know, looking at these riots and everything, you know, he talked about, had one back in August where, he decided, well, I need to go get some ammunition. Well, guess what?
There ain't none.
Only very recently have a few calibers started to appear in any abundance, which is one of the reasons why, for example, I'm very happy that I have a 16-gauge shotgun, because there was... nobody went out and bought up all the 16-gauge buckshot.
Well, no, because so, it's like, you know, the tiniest. Well, okay, there are smaller bores, but.
I want to put it to you this way. The great divide in terms of Civil War preparedness, okay, if that's what we're talking about here, the big divide is not whether you're carrying a big gun or a small gun.
Or one, it's one at all.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Trust me, you know, if the bad guys show up and you're in a position to return fire, they'll go somewhere else, okay? Don't be a soft target. You can pop off a few rimfire 22 at them, and, that can be pretty painful to get hit with a 22.
Well,
it can be fatal.
It can be very fatal, but one of the techniques that certain less than desirable tyrannies use is, quite frankly, they use suppressed 22 caliber pistols, and they're not trying to kill someone. You poke a 22 caliber hole in somebody's lung, and it's hard to breathe. And that puts them out of action without creating a whole lot of other unpleasantness. And so, but the point is that we should keep calm, but we should be prepared for what we should have a plan.
All this talk about civil war, it disturbs me. Look, like I said, I have
advice: stay home. You don't need to get out into the street and play confrontation games. It's dumb.
No. Right. Thank you.
Yes.
Stay home and you know, be prepared. You know, good old Boy Scout motto, be prepared. And but don't go looking for trouble, folks.
And quite frankly, as long as the people are still just on your lawn, let them walk around. You know, you can replace the shrubbery easily. Because...
Except when there's a Molotov cocktail involved and you're living in a Victorian.
That's right. You you know, until things, best way to avoid danger is to stay away from it. I mean, for every once in a while, somebody asked me what kind of gun I would carry if I knew I was going to a gunfight. And the answer is I would stay home rather than go to the gunfight.
Second piece of advice, stay out of crowds for only one reason. Somebody with one of those slap gloves, or what they are calling tactical gloves now, it's basically a glove that's brass knuckles. Don't get hit with one of those. It really, really hurts.
Yeah, you don't want to, like I said, that, you know, but I
see the thing is these crowds are full of crazy people.
Yes, they are.
And crazy people are dangerous.
Yes. Well, okay. This week, our annual, our weekly feature, Crazy People Are Dangerous, is about a couple of sisters from the west side of Chicago. Jessica Hill, 21, and her sister Jayla Hill, 18, were arrested Sunday after they attacked a security guard in a shoe store. The sisters were not wearing masks as required under the city's COVID-19 policy. The guard was stabbed repeatedly. A Cook County judge on Tuesday denied bond for the sisters, who were charged with attempted murder after one sister allegedly held the victim down by his hair as the other stabbed him in the chest and body 27 times.
Now, see, he should have shot them in the leg.
As Joe Biden would say, well, I don't think he was an armed security guard, but according to Cook County prosecutors, upon their arrival in the store, the victim asked the Hill sisters to put on masks and use hand sanitizer to help protect against the spread of COVID-19. The shoe store actually will give you, right? Mask and hand sanitizer. And so this turned into a fight, and they stabbed him 27 times, and the judge says it's the complete randomness of this. But let's face it, these people are Biden voters, okay? I've seen their faces. I've seen their mug shots, and trust me, these masks, they would have looked much better with the masks on. But I can hear that boogie-woogie piano, which tells me that it's time. We're going to be back Tuesday with a special election podcast. So be prepared to joining us here at 7 p.m.
Yep, we're coming
on Tuesday.
We're going live just as the polls start to close.
Yeah, wait a minute. Oh, coming up, it's Alabama 20, Mississippi State 0. And so folks, we will talk to you Tuesday, and we are out of here.
Good night, folks. Good night, Diana.
Good night. Keep rolling down.
Mr. Breeze.